Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm thrilled to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. Roger Basin will be joining me. He's the founder of the Atlantic Ocean Aquaculture, and he'll be joining me in a little bit on the show. But before he comes on, I want to share with you my weekly recipe and some things going on in the city and around the area that you may want to know about. For those of you that do not know, although you all should know at this point, tonight is the Climate March down in New York City. We're meeting at Battery Park all the way downtown and then marching to City Hall and ending in the park up there. And so it is a really important event. This is a national event taking place around the country, although New York City is the kickoff. Tonight we're doing it on Thursday night because on Saturday, which is the date, September 8th, where it's happening around the country, September 8th in New York City is the West Indies Parade, so we can't do the parade or the march that day in New York City. So they've scheduled the march for tonight, starting at 5:30 in Battery Park. I will be there. I hope many of you will be joining me. If you can't make it tonight, please consider finding a march near you on September 8th. That's Saturday, September 8th. We need to let our elected officials know that climate change needs to become front and center and inform every decision they make. We can't keep bulling around. I mean, we need to really push them to take this issue up really in a serious manner. It is affecting everything. We're seeing the wildfires, we're seeing flooding, we're seeing more hurricanes. The ramifications of climate change are only starting to be felt. And for future generations, it's just so sad. I mean, my kids are in positions to have children, and we're watching babies being born, and I'm just concerned for the future of this planet and what they're going to have to face as they grow up. And I want to make it as easy for them as possible. And I know all of you out there listening to my show also want to. So please come out to the Climate March. And if you can't make it to the Climate March, there's so many other things you can do. I mean, this week I wrote about the Natural Resource Defense Council and how they're fighting big time against the EPA and the cuts that our current administration is making. And they've actually been winning. They've won 21 out of the 25 cases that they've brought to court so far. The Keystone XL tar sands is still in court, and they're holding that back from getting moved forward. The nerve gas pesticide, chlorpyrifos, I always say it wrong, but that chemical is bad news. It's a nerve gas. We need to get it out of our food supply, and the EPA should be doing that job, and they're not, and so we need to push them to do that. Monsanto, all the things that are going on with them, the court decisions to acknowledge Roundup as carcinogenic and as a cause of lymphoma, that's moving forward. Endangered porpoises, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, all these things that our current administration is trying to cut. The Natural Resource Defense Council is out there fighting for it, as is the Food and Water Watch, as is River Keeper. I mean, there's so many good organizations out there. And so if you cannot make it to the Climate March, please find an organization that you can volunteer with, that you can donate to. We need everybody who cares about this planet to really get on board and become an activist. There's just too many things that are really important right now and that are in the news that we need to all participate in. The River Keeper, wrote about this situation. The Army Corps of Engineers is trying to build a dam that's going to choke off the Hudson River and create a barrier from Sandy Hook, New Jersey, to Breezy Point, Queens, and then across the East River through by the Throgs Neck Bridge. And that's just going to be a disaster to further climate change situations with flooding when we have a hurricane and other natural disasters. It's going to wreck the whole ecosystem of the river, prohibit fish migration, sediment moving, and also the removal of natural wastewater. So that's really a bad thing, and the riverkeeper is really fighting for that. So there's just so many different things that you can get involved in that you really need to. So we need everyone to become an activist. I also wrote this week about fast food restaurants. We know that they're contributing to the obesity problem and to our health. But all these chain restaurants now that are out there that people think are a step up from fast food restaurants, well, a report just came out that that's not the case. Most of these chain restaurants give huge portions, the quality of the food is horrible, and the amount of calories and fat and sodium that are in these dishes are really, really bad. So I think they talked about the Cheesecake Factory's breakfast burrito, you know, a wonderful way to start the day with 2,700 calories and 4,600 milligrams of sodium and 73 grams of saturated fat. I mean, that's like more than a full day's quantity of everything. So we really need to watch where we eat. Do your research. If you're going to go out to eat, make sure it's a restaurant that supports the sustainable movement, that sources their ingredients well, that has real chefs behind the line, not just defrosting frozen food. And get back into the kitchen and start cooking. I can't tell you what fun it is. I love cooking. I love sharing my passion for cooking with people. And cooking can become the evening's activity. Invite friends over and make dinners together. We need to cook more. Last week I wrote about how kids who see parents cook are so much more likely to cook themselves. And we need to role model that for our families and for our communities. We need to bring people together around the table, around good, healthy food, and enjoy those pleasures and pass those pleasures on. They're just traditions that we just cannot afford to let go by the wayside. So, on that note, I want to share with you some really great things coming up. Like I said, tonight is the Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice March in New York City. And it's a national call out to our elected officials to make climate change front and center. We'll be meeting tonight at 5:30 in Battery Park, so I hope you can join us. And then September 8th is the huge march in Washington, D.C. Thousands and thousands of people, hopefully hundreds of thousands of people, will be at that march in Washington, D.C. There's a local march here on Long Island in Long Beach, Long Island, and that's being hosted by Food and Water Watch and some other wonderful organizations. So if you're local to Long Island, you can go there. But you can go to the People's Climate or peoplesclimate.org website and find a march near you. Wherever you are in the country, there will be a march near you. And if there isn't one, quickly try to organize one. But we need to come together around this. September 8th is the Organic Food for the People Cookout. This is being hosted by the Just Food Organization and the Tehuti Maz Community Garden, and that's where it will be. It will be at the Community Garden. So go to the Just Food website for tickets, and the tickets prices are varied, starting from $35 up to $75, but it will support Just Food and this wonderful community garden. September 16th is a great event, this is the 12th annual North Fork Foodie Tour, and it's a self-guided food tour put together between the Peconic Land Trust and the North Fork Reform Synagogue, but it's something that you can do by yourself. They highlight so many different great locations on the North Fork where you can go and tour the farm, tour the cheese makers, tour the winemakers, and it's just great. And tickets are available at Brown Paper Tickets. But to all of these events, you can find links on my website. If you go to my website, you can find links to everything. September 16th is the 9th annual Boston Local Food Festival. And that's downtown Boston. It's a free event, and that should be that always is fun. September 21st through the 23rd is the Aquaponics Association 2018 conference. And that is also a wonderful event taking place. If you are interested in aquaponics, that is some place you want to be. September 22nd is also Combating Climate Crisis on Long Island, and the Sisters of St. Joseph in Brentwood are hosting this event from 10 to 3. It's a free event, but come out and talk about the climate crisis on Long Island, how you can get involved, and what actions you can learn to take. September 24th to the 29th, Agritecture Exchange is taking place in Brooklyn. There's many different events going on at their location on Meserol Street in Brooklyn. So go to the Agritecture Exchange website, or again at my website, iegreen.com, and you'll find links to all these events. September 24th, Slow Food North Shore is hosting a Snail of Approval dinner at the Perennial Restaurant. September 25th, Stone Barn is having their annual gala, which is always a wonderful event, a bit pricey, but their events are great. So if you can afford it, it's fun. September 29th to the 30th is the California Vegetarian Food Festival. Prices vary for that, too, and that's in Hollywood, California. And that is a great event if you are out in that area. Also on the 29th to the 30th is the New York Vegandale Festival. And the Vegandale Festival is a huge mecca. It's taking place in Randall's Island, but it started in Toronto, downtown Toronto, and has been spreading. So it will be from 11 to 7 all day at Randall's Island. So check that out. October 1st, FERN, which is the Food and Environment Reporting Network, is hosting Ruth Rochelle and Dirk Candy chef Amanda Cohn for a conversation. And that should be a great event as well. So anyway, I hope to see many of you there. I now want to share with you my weekly recipe before I invite my guests on. This week I made coleslaw. I made vegan coleslaw because I have so many cabbages coming out of the garden. And next week you'll probably see some stuffed cabbage on the menu. But this week I made some vegan coleslaw. We were having a barbecue. We were doing barbecue tempeh and corn on the cob, and this coleslaw just goes great with it. And you can make this coleslaw either with a vegan mayo, or you can actually just leave it with the vinegar and have it more as a pickled salad. Either way, it's delicious, and I made two different batches because I know some people at my gathering did not want the fat from the mayo, so I made it both ways. So you want to, the ingredients you need is one green cabbage, finely shredded. I put in half a red cabbage for color. It just makes it so much more beautiful. 5 carrots shredded, 3 tablespoons chopped parsley, 2 tablespoons celery seed. And this is, a classic ingredient. It seems like it's so little and nothing, but it really adds so much flavor to the coleslaw. 2 red onions, thinly sliced, 2 green peppers, thinly sliced, 1 cup of white vinegar, and a half a cup of apple cider vinegar. Then I added 1.5 cups of organic vegan mayo. I love the Just Mayo brand. That's a really good one. 1/2 teaspoon salt and 1/2 teaspoon pepper. You can also add other vegetables if you'd like. You can add other colors of peppers, which is beautiful. You can add some celery if you'd like. But I started by marinating the cabbage and the red onion in the 1 cup of white vinegar and the 1/2 cup of apple cider vinegar. And you want to let that marinate for at least 4 hours or overnight. And I find marinating it, putting it into plastic Ziploc bags is really a great way, because then you can just keep turning the bags over to help the marinade move through the cabbage everywhere and get it covered. Because if you don't put it in the plastic bag, you just need to go out to the bowl often and stir it up so that the marinade that sinks to the bottom gets stirred in and marinates the whole cabbage. Then you want to drain the coleslaw or the cabbage before you add the mayo. So you're going to drain it. Then you're going to combine the carrots, the celery seed, the green pepper, the salt, pepper, parsley. And if you're adding mayo, add the mayo at this time too, and mix it all up, and you can serve it immediately, or it can be stored for up to a week in the refrigerator. And it's really delicious. And it, like I said, if you don't want to add the mayonnaise, you can just stop right there and just serve it after you drain the vinegar out, and it's a delicious pickled salad. So enjoy that. And that is it for all of my announcements. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you My guest this week is Roger Basin. He is the founder of the Atlantic Ocean Agriculture, which uses innovation to grow sustainably in the ocean. And he has extensive experience with ocean-based projects. And over the past 20 years, he's been involved in innovations in tidal wave energy technology, site selection, field study permits, and project development. And I'm going to let you tell us more about what you do. Roger, are you with me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for your great introduction and all the news and the delicious recipe you just shared. Thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. I do it every week. And I will be at that march tonight and really excited to be joining with thousands of others to stand up against climate change. It's just, you know, it's just such an important thing for community to come together around issues that are important to us and to make a stand. So anyway, I'm thrilled with the work that you're doing. Can you tell us a little bit about Atlantic Ocean Aquaculture?
Well, yes. And I think we have a very solid and great connection between what you're talking about with food choices and climate action, particularly as it impacts ocean health. And that really is the driver of why I started the business, and it's a key element to one of the solutions to these threats of climate change and the global warming and how it impacts ocean health. So, in a nutshell, what we're doing is developing an ocean permaculture type project provides for nutritious sea vegetables, primarily kelp and other seaweeds like dulse that are very nutritious. But at the same time, the ocean farm, these seaweeds sequester enormous amounts of carbon that reduce the threat of climate change, and also impact and reduce ocean acidification, which is kind of, some people call, the evil twin of climate change, is the carbon and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is absorbed into the ocean surface and creates carbonic acid, which makes the oceans more acidic every year. And then that threatens to all of the calcium-bearing organisms, the corals, the oysters, the mussels. So many of the organisms have these protective shells, and they've already begun to dissolve in certain areas due to the CO2 in the atmosphere. So what we're doing is setting up ocean farms that generate very nutritious sea vegetables that can be bought on the open market. And at the same time, there are significant environmental benefits or eco benefits from the action of the farms themselves. So that's the key effort that we're bringing forward. And I'm working to apply about 20 years of experience in ocean energy, putting equipment on the seabed and whatnot, with a background that I have in permaculture. For many years, I ran a permaculture farm in Hawaii and actually ran the AmeriCorps program back in the 1990s, all on sustainability and community agriculture. So I'm kind of combining all of these interests into this new venture with Atlantic Ocean Aquaculture.
Wow, sounds fascinating. I've had other people on talking about growing vegetables in the ocean too, and I was wondering, can you share with us, if you're growing sea vegetables and it's sequestering the carbon, does the sea vegetables absorb some of the toxicity from the ocean that would then make it unhealthy to eat, or are the sea vegetables feed off of that and it doesn't create toxicity in the vegetable itself?
Well, that's a very good question. And, of course, there are What so is if there is, for example, there's a lot of seaweeds grown in the Pacific. Japan is known for the nori and all the seaweeds and whatnot, hijiki, et cetera. And with the Fukushima accident there in 2012, much of the Pacific Ocean has at least some trace of radioactive components. So that is something that's a concern. That is one of the big impulses. We're in the fresh, clean, cool waters of Maine, is that these waters have very high purity and water quality. Another aspect of what you're driving at, I think, is a very key point, is that the ocean plastics that are very much talked about as this huge problem of the gyres, where the, you know, huge garbage patches of floating plastics, mm-hmm. and whatnot. These break down into microplastics, into little, you know, fraction of a millimeter type of pieces, and it gets into the food chain, into the fish, into the birds, and, you know, the various turtles and marine mammals. They're all becoming impacted by these microplastics. And that's not a problem either for us, because the plastics are not, you know, absorbed into the sea vegetables, the plants. They just mm-hmm. extract excess nutrients like carbon and nitrogen that, when they build up, create dead zones in the ocean. You know, they fuel a lot of growth of algae. Absorb all the oxygen, the fish die, and they create these dead zones that accumulate, you know, particularly in the warm weather. So the ocean farms reverse that process. They take up the nutrients and they transform them into clean, edible foods. So the plastics and the radionuclides are not a problem with what we're working with right now.
Mm-hmm. And is ocean agriculture only raising sea vegetables, or are you also raising seafood?
Well, that's good. There's several models, you know, that are used. We're looking at a combination of, you know, we get a lease for a certain ocean footprint to run the farm, and then we set it up with equipment and long lines where the kelp grows. And our original model was to combine this with oysters and mussels, which work in symbiotic harmony with the seaweed, so that they each gather different sets of nutrients and kind of feed off each other and the nutrients that naturally occur in the ocean. But what we have done is sort of evolve our model into looking at just the seaweeds themselves, and looking to really co-locate with ourselves on the seaweeds themselves. There's so many. There are 10 commercial seaweeds that grow in Maine, and we're looking at working with about 5 or 6 of them.
Mm-hmm. Let's backtrack just a little bit with some of your experience. You know, how did you first come to work in ocean agriculture? I know you started by saying you had a permaculture farm in Hawaii, but how did you transition into your work with oceans and marine development?
That's a good question. I've been working in ocean energy, working with wave and tidal energy. I actually worked on the first tidal energy plant in the U.S., which is in New York City, and it took fully 10 years to get that project permitted. And subsequently, I've worked in different parts of the world, and there is this problem with new technology to get projects permitted and this type of thing. So about a year ago, I had a very existential moment to think, well, this isn't really moving as fast as I would like. I wonder how my background can best be used to address these critical issues. And where you started the conversation today on climate change, it's, you know, this is a key concern for all of us. So how can my background be best used to address that issue? And so when I discovered about a year ago this whole concept of ocean permaculture and ocean farms that help to adjust and the ocean acidification, there's a halo of clean water around these farms because they suck up the excess nutrients and carbon. And the whole climate change is issued as is addressed as ecosystem services that combine not only the production of nutritious foods that can go to market, but also provide all these benefits. So that was really a big driver for me, is to see how I can best bring my skill base to find solutions to this vexing problem of climate change.
Mm-hmm. And do these sea farms at all affect anything having to do with the coral reefs or the life for the fish, or do the fish feed off of the sea farms that you're raising?
Well, the seaweeds provide a very dense a marine habitat, and the fish naturally, you know, part of their life cycle in terms of predator prey relationships, whether they can hide and exist in the seaweed banks naturally, and so marine habitat enhances the finfish species. And curiously, you know, one of the big drivers for not only growing sea vegetables, but also finfish in the oceans and, farmed fish, is that the world production of seaweeds and farmed fish is now greater than the wild catch worldwide. The ocean health has been so degraded and overfished that more than 50% of our seafood, seaweed and fish and shellfish are farmed. It's a key issue. Some of these farms, if they're just finfish, they use a lot of external fertilizer. That's not the case with our ocean farms. They're fertilized by the natural minerals that are in the sea. And in fact, they form a scrubbing function of sucking up all the excess nutrients that cause the dead zones and this type of thing. So, these are definitely eco-friendly and at the same time provide some serious nutrition. A lot of the kelps are considered superfoods. They have enormous variety of vitamins and minerals and micronutrients, bioflavonoids, all kinds of healing properties. So it's a key solution to this climate change issue that you've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. And I understand there's hundreds of varieties of different sea vegetables, and we're, you know, here in our country, we're used to only a few of them, you know, like you mentioned, nori, hiziki, kelp, wakame, what else, kombu. But, you know, I know there's hundreds of varieties. Are you growing many different varieties? Are you sticking with the ones that we know? Because I would assume with sea vegetables, there's a lot of issues around biodiversity the same way there is in our, you know, regular vegetables.
Well, that's a very good point that you're making, and you've named the major ones right there. I mean, there is a total of 10,000 different seaweeds, sea vegetables.
10,000, okay. I was saying hundreds. 10,000.
Well, that's the total of what's out there. Many of them have been used for key cures to different types of diseases. You know, goiter, with the iodine that's in, has been treated with seaweeds for hundreds of years. So there's a huge area of pharmaceuticals But with respect to your question, yes, we have to go in order to make our business model work. We have to go with these, commonly marketed sea vegetables. But in added value type of applications, for example, there's a whole huge area of cosmetics. Bladderwrack is one of the seaweeds that grows in Maine, and it's often used for detox baths, for different soaps, for skin creams and cosmetics, facial cleansers and masks, this type of thing. So that's one area that we're looking at in terms of the seaweeds that we're marketing. But what you mentioned, kelp is a major component. It's more also being used for animal feeds and pet foods. You know, the nutritional value has a significant impact on their health. So we're in the process of now looking at added value to the different seaweeds. But on the food side, I think you nailed most of the possibilities right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I put kelp in my garden. The plants love the extra nutrients from the kelp.
Yeah.
So, Roger, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk more about how the ocean farms are actually set up, and maybe you can walk us through the operation. So, everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Roger Basin, founder of the Atlantic Ocean Aquaculture. Be right back.
I'm Gary Nall, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. We would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message can reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Roger Basin, founder of the Atlantic Ocean Aquaculture, and we're talking about the ocean aquaculture farm that he has set up in Maine. So, Roger, are you back with me?
Yes, I'm right here.
Great. So I wanted to just go through some of the process, like how the setup of the ocean farm. I know you said you're up in Maine. Can you walk us through the operation a bit and how the food business side of this works?
Well, very good. Yeah, the physical setup of the farm is such that you obtain a lease for a certain footprint on the seabed and the ocean space. And this is vetted through
Who's the lease from?
Well, the lease is from, in Maine, it's from the Department of Marine Resources in Maine. In New York State, for example, it would be with the Department of State, which owns the state seabed that goes out 3 miles from the coastline. That's the state limit. And then if it's out beyond 3 miles, up to 200 miles, that's the U.S. federal, they're called the Economic Enterprise Zone.
And how far out are your farms?
Just a few hundred meters offshore, about 1,000 meters, a little more than half a mile, right? They're quite close to shore, but what we do is basically set up anchors. If you imagine a rectangle and just big cement anchors in each one of the corners, maybe 100 meters by 1,000 meters in size. That would be 10 hectares or 25 acres. And then what we do is bring a buoy up from the anchor to the surface. So you could imagine four buoys sort of on the surface forming a rectangle. And then from each of those buoys, we drop a little rigid pipe down 7 feet. And from that 7 foot depth, we run a grid of long lines that are just like lines, like parallel lines on a sheet of paper. And each one of those runs out 1,000 meters. And we wrap around that what's called a seed string. And the seed strings are very fine cotton strings that are usually 100 meters in length each. And they're wrapped around a spool. And what we do is go get the seeds from nature when the kelps in the natural state produce their seeds and cultivate them in a lab, like in a big aquarium tank. And the seed strings are placed in there, and they absorb billions of seeds. And so as we develop the farm, we run the seed string around the long line, these parallel long lines, 7 feet below the water surface, and plant them in November. And 4 or 5 months later, there's an enormous growth of kelp off of these little seeds that looked like just a sort of a brown tint on the line. Become the average is about 17 kilograms per meter, or it's almost 40 pounds of seaweed per meter of line. That's then harvested and dried and packaged, sometimes processed and powdered and made into products for sale. So that's, in summary, that's the process of the farm.
I would think that, so you say it takes up 25 acres and that this would be very dense farming, correct? Right?
Yes.
What you're describing sounds like it would be very dense growth. That doesn't affect the fish at all? Like, they don't get caught in the seaweed? They can manage their way through it and everything?
Yeah, they actually like it. They hang out there. And there's all sorts of predator-prey relationships that get set up in the within this sort of kelp forest that gets developed. Out in California, they have these gigantic kelp forests that run 30, 40 meters long each, and they're known to grow as much as 2 feet in a day. So it's just very rapid, very hardy, a key part of the ocean ecology. And it's really, in one sense, just design with nature. We're using the natural nutrients of the ocean to grow out this biomass that also sequesters enormous amounts of carbon, as much as at least four times as much carbon is sequestered per unit area in a kelp farm than in a land-based forest.
Wow. That's huge.
Yeah, you'll see in the literature some people have said up to 40 times as much, but I've never been able to prove that with my calculation. So I just conservatively, it's four times as much. So these grow very fast. It's a huge driver and solution to climate change because it begins to sequester the carbon, you know, with all the deforestation that's going worldwide. This not only provides the food, but it also sequesters carbon. And another element of our business is to just build mitigation banks. I've worked with some of the real global experts in the seaweed field, and you know they have a vision of hundreds of square kilometers of kelp fields in the deep ocean and in the EEZ, the offshore enterprise zone, where the marine spatial planning enables huge forests of the kelp that can sequester enormous amounts of carbon and really put a brake on climate change and allow time for us to adapt to the many changes that you just talked about in your introduction.
Mm-hmm. And so this model is completely replicable, and people can take it and do it every other places as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm working with, one of my great inspirations was with Brian Van Herzen, who's working with 100 nations in the Global South and in all the United Nations conferences on growing seaweed as not only a source of revenue and income, but also to create some of these so-called mitigation banks that mitigate carbon and then drop the seaweed and sequester it in the deep ocean where, due to the temperature change and whatnot, you've locked the carbon down into the deep ocean, and it's a serious solution to global solution to this vexing problem we all are facing right now.
Mm-hmm. And then how is it harvested so that, you know, the harvesting portion of this project is not detrimental to the ocean? Is it harvested by hand?
Well, it's smaller plots, and there are a lot of farms that are 10 acres and smaller out there that, a team of people can pull in the ropes and take off the kelp and seaweed and wash it and dry it on like clotheslines, and then process and package it. So, you know,
can you take the strings out of the ocean and hang those up on a clothesline without taking it like right on the string that it's on, so you're not transferring it, or you have to take it off the strings in the ocean and put it onto the clothesline type of thing to dry?
Yeah, usually it's taken off because the ropes can be reused year to year.
Okay. So you leave the ropes in place and you just are removing the seaweed.
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I guess I thought you were saying you had to take the ropes off and put them into the tanks kind of to get them seated.
That's on the seed side. That's like in the late summer, the seeds are collected from kelp that are producing the seeds and gametes in the natural ocean setting. And then there is a period where, in order to farm them, you grow these out in tanks and put them on these little strings. And then once you set up the farm with the long lines that are regular ropes, as you feed that rope out, you unspool the seed string and you put the thin string along the thicker rope.
And then they become seeded. Kind of one over time.
Exactly. Well, they won the little string around the major rope. It's very tightly held on there, and the kelp grows down from that
right.
location.
Right. Okay, so if the ropes stay in place and you just keep putting new seed string on each season when you do it. And how often, you said every 4 months you can start a new crop?
Well, it's this particular type of seaweed is because it's related to water temperature. When in November, it's a winter crop, so you put the seed seed strings in the mid-November, and then it's March, April, May is the harvest time. So that's a winter crop. There are other seaweeds that can be grown or wildly, wild harvested in a sustainable harvesting plan. So you can both farm the seaweeds and you can also just collect the wild seaweeds. And that both of those types of operations are going on in Maine right now.
Mm-hmm. So that's the kelp is the winter crop that you're talking about?
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And do you also grow nori?
That is a product of a seaweed they call laver, L-A-V-E-R, and we're wildcrafting that or wild harvesting that. We're not cultivating it as yet. We're starting simple and going to the more complex.
Uh-huh. Okay, but is nori able to be harvested?
The Japanese are doing that right now, and that technology. I mean, about 90% of the farmed seaweed in Maine are one of four varieties of kelp. So that's where we're starting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know I asked you this earlier, but what was your decision in not also growing the seaweed? I know a lot of places are using oysters, in particular here in New York. I know in the area around LaGuardia Airport, they've been cleaning it up with oyster farms. But of course, those oysters once they get all that toxicity out of the water, they're not available for being eaten. And that's what I was kind of asking you about the seaweed, whether that absorbs any of the toxicity. But in your decision not to grow seafood as well, can you share that with us?
Shellfish, yeah. Yeah, well, the shellfish, it was very interesting. You know, our model initially had the seaweed growing near the surface and the shellfish sort of mid ocean. What we experienced in our fundraising side of things was there was a number of groups that were and individuals that were very interested in investing in our effort had an objection to they were vegetarian either from religious grounds. They were both Buddhist and Hindus that were high net worth individuals that wanted to see. They saw the light here and the climate change and the nutritious food, and they wanted to invest, but they didn't want to invest on the shellfish side. So at the same time, we talked to a number of shellfish growers that thought they could balance and improve their bottom line by adding seaweed. So what we decided, and to answer your question, is we're just separating ocean. Atlantic Ocean Aquaculture is working on sea vegetables and seaweeds, and then we're doing deals to co-locate with other shellfish groups that with mussels, blue mussels, and oysters to grow them in an adjacent lease. So that's how we address that particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And when you do grow shellfish, how do you know how much of the toxicity that they're taking out of the water is in the shellfish itself, and at what point are they just serving a purpose of cleaning up the water and need to be discarded, or can they still be eaten? How does one determine
that? I think you're talking about Malinowski and the Billion Oyster Project around New York City, which, back in the day, the oysters were, New York City was, had, I think, over 350 square miles of oyster beds, and the oysters grew up to a foot long. That was in the natural state. And the waters here were clean and pristine before colonization. You know, there's a great, the Big Apple, there's the Big Oyster, there's a book out about that whole, pre-colonial aspect of the shellfish around the city. But what they're doing is, they're cleaning up, they're using the oysters as ecosystem cleansers, and those are not edible. In the ocean space, all these New England states have enormous testing of every town and village, every part of the ocean coast that is cultivated has a significant testing, you know, monthly testing to see exactly what the toxicity levels are. And these shellfish areas are prohibited and mapped, and they have marine patrols that go out, and you just can't work in those areas if they're closed. So as I say, this isn't an issue that we deal with right now. Our partners that do shellfish farming have to be very aware of this. And it's very highly monitored, very highly monitored. You know, and then there's also inspection once the oysters and shellfish come out of the water, that they are inspected and, you know, prior to and also licensed before you can transport them. And there's very strict requirements around the handling of shellfish once they hit shore, to be maintained at a certain temperature, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's a lot of people looking at this one.
Right. I would think so. Yeah. Because it's really interesting to be able to use, you know, as we discussed earlier, using aquaculture and permaculture, you know, using agriculture to help mitigate climate change as opposed to just adding to it. Because we know our current agricultural model adds so much of the greenhouse gas emissions that bring on climate change. And, you know, finding ways to use it to remedy this is really outstanding. It's great. So where do you see the future of your business and aquaculture in general going in this country?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Right now, the total seafood, both seaweed and shellfish and finfish, we import in the United States $14 billion worth of seafood a year. That's our trade imbalance just with these seafoods. So it's time for the U.S. And a lot of these are, you know, there are five countries. It's mostly China, Japan, Korea, Philippines, and Indonesia produce 95% of the seaweeds that are consumed in the world. And the Asian populations have been using these seaweeds in their medicine and their diet for hundreds of thousands of years. So, and their health reflects it. You know, they have longer lifespans and less cardiovascular and different diseases because the foods are so nutritious. So I think it's time for the U.S. to look at, and our mission is really to help build a market for these nutritious foods that not only improve personal health, and actually food is medicine, is that it has this huge climate upside for ocean acidification, carbon sequestration, and absorbing excess nutrients. But not only that, you know, looking at the big picture, land-based agriculture uses enormous amounts of water, and as you mentioned, artificial fertilizers to maintain the levels of food production that simply can't compete with the global world population that's projected to reach 9 billion by 2050. But ocean farms can. And I think this is why we've had enormous interest from China and India, where people are concerned about the issue of food security. And the ocean farms, the land-based farms worldwide are about 8% of the global land area. But ocean farms can feed the entire world population on just 0.03% of the global ocean. And the U.S. alone, on 5% of the EEZ, our 200-mile offshore limit, can feed the world. And this is, you know, secure. This is World Bank Group numbers and UN FAO certified numbers that are true and accurate. There's no exaggeration here. So the ocean farms in the future, I think we'll be seeing, of necessity, more and more operations offshore, hopefully improving ocean health offshore, increasing marine habitat, sequestering carbon, and improving the overall nutrition both in the U.S. And worldwide.
Sounds great. And is there any anything involved in the processing other than just drying it? There's no chemicals used in the drying process or anything like that, is there?
Yeah, no, most of this is just, you know, air dried at this point. You know, 2 days at 85 degrees under a plastic tarp dries the seaweed. It's washed and packed. Well, that depends on, you know, the ultimate use of the product. Seaweed is in so many different products. The warm water seaweeds, the capophycus and the red seaweeds that are grown in Africa and Indonesia and the Philippines are used as thickeners. You know, they're processed and sometimes the whole plant, like with Irish moss, you can put it in a blender and add it to make chocolate pudding. It tastes delicious, and it's the most nutritious chocolate pudding you'll ever have. It's loaded with minerals and vitamins and all kinds of nutrients that are very healthy for you. I'd love to give you a recipe on that one to share with your radio audience.
Please send it to me, and I will share it.
I will. And that's just one example. Seaweed is found in toothpaste. It's used in beer to create foam, and there's actually two types of beer with two brands that include seaweed in the brewing process. So there's a huge variety, both in the cosmetic side, the pharmacology, nutraceuticals, these foods like salads and smoothies that we talked about. So there's quite a variety. So the processing of the seaweed, you know, if you just want to throw it in soups, dried, you know, is a good way to get it, and put some in your soups. Powders work with smoothies, and some of the fresh seaweed, once it's soaked and blended, can go in and make puddings, jellies, and jams. So it's a good way to add nutrients to some of our favorite foods.
Yeah, although we have to be careful because I know carrageenan, which is a seaweed, has been shown to be toxic. And, you know, there's a lot of people working really hard to try to get carrageenan out of the organic market.
Right. So, that's exactly the point, is that if it's chemically extracted from, let's take something like Irish moss, if it's chemically extracted, the composition is altered, and that's why these warnings are issued.
We're out of time, Roger. I'm so sorry. This always happens. Anyway, I will share your information with everyone. You want to just quickly say your website?
Right. It's simply AtlanticOceanAquaculture.com.
Wonderful. And I will share that information on my website, too. Everyone who joined us, thank you for joining us. Roger, thank you for joining me today. And everyone, have a great rest of the week. And I hope to see you at the march tonight. Yay!